So we're going to move on now and talk about prostate cancer. Really excited to have our group up here talk about one of my favorite topics. I've already mentioned the EMBARK study in the breast cancer session because I love the EMBARK study. I find anyone looking at M0 disease, and we're going to talk about that and many, many other things. We have Sunil Gandhi back again to be the co-moderator here. So, got Dr. Oh and Dr. Agarwal, and we're going to start out talking about hormonal therapy of prostate cancer. William, great to see you again. It's been a while. Thanks a lot. So, again, hormonal therapy of patients with prostate cancer used to be a fairly simple discussion. Each year, it seems to be getting more complicated. Why don't we start out, William? You're happy to see you now in Yale. What a great team you have there now in prostate cancer. So let's talk about some of the data.
Sure. You're right. It's been 70 years since we learned that androgen deprivation therapy is targeted therapy, right, Neil? But there's a lot of new pieces. These are the abstracts I'm going to be talking about. But I've shown this clinical states model my whole career now, over 25 years. And of course, we know that you start on the left, clinically localized disease, and as you progress to the right side, where you really die of prostate cancer in the metastatic CRPC state, the whole question is, can you delay progression across this long spectrum of disease, the 10 to 15 years, as these men get older and may die of other diseases? So I'm going to first focus on this biochemical recurrence space, because as you were mentioning in the intro, EMBARK was, I think, really an update of an old concept, which is, can you use androgen-targeted therapies, the so-called ARPIs, or androgen receptor pathway inhibitors, the blockers to, in fact, treat prostate cancer instead of androgen deprivation therapy, which, as we know, patients do not like losing their testosterone. These guys do not like low testosterone states. So this was a randomized three-arm study looking at ADT alone, leuprolide, versus ADT plus enzalutamide versus, in this case, the red box, enzalutamide alone. And as we'll show in the data here, if you look at the upper left side, you can see that, in fact, not surprisingly, the combination of leuprolide plus enzalutamide was associated with an improvement in metastasis-free survival. In many ways, this is not surprising. Combination therapy has shown itself to be valuable in multiple disease states in prostate cancer. You more potently inhibit the androgen pathway, and you'll get better outcomes. I think the biggest surprise of EMBARK was this arm, which is the two arms that were comparing leuprolide monotherapy to enzalutamide monotherapy. And this surprised me. I think it surprised a lot of people in the field, because we had, as you know, going way back, we tried bicalutamide. And bicalutamide is a very weak androgen antagonist, whereas enzalutamide is a much more potent one. And in this case, metastasis-free survival was superior in the enzalutamide arm compared to the ADT arm. And I think that is really probably the important take-home message, because, of course, the FDA approved enzalutamide monotherapy as an alternative in biochemical recurrent disease. Now, if you look at many of the secondary endpoints on the left of these forest plots, you can see basically all of the endpoints. If you compare on the top the combination of leuprolide plus enzalutamide, and on the bottom leuprolide versus enzalutamide, you can see they mostly favor either the enzalutamide arms, basically in combination or as monotherapy. And in fact, I think the biggest question from a pragmatic level is, what's the difference for the patients? And you can see this was the cartoon that was shown in the NEJM paper, and you can see that, for example, in orange here, there's substantially less hot flashes. You get more side effects when you do the combo. That's not a huge surprise. But if you take away the leuprolide, you get, I think generally speaking, patients tolerate this enzalutamide monotherapy better. Not just hot flashes. You can see fatigue was relatively comparable, but they generally have a better sense of well-being in my experience, because their testosterone, in fact, it doesn't even go down. It actually goes up, because you're blocking androgen signaling, and the pituitary thinks, I got to make more testosterone. And so you actually see higher levels of testosterone in these patients. So just subjectively, they have more muscle strength, they have more energy in general than what you might be seeing in these curves. And of course, you can't see the right side, but in general, the quality of life and the tolerability of this regimen seems to be either better or at least the same. So the opposite direction, Dr. Agarwal did this PRESTO study, he was the lead author and PI, was if we have one ARPI, would two be better? And this was a three-arm study also, but everyone got an LHRH analog, and arm B got apalutamide, and arm C got both apalutamide and abiraterone. This is a question that we've been asking for quite some time and would love to hear Rahul's take on this. But basically, the two arms looking at RPFS look no different. In other words, and we've seen other studies like this that suggest that even though apalutamide, you remember, is an androgen receptor antagonist and abiraterone blocks the lyase that produces testosterone, the combination doesn't seem to be better and it probably just adds toxicity. So you can see these are, on the left is just apalutamide, on the right is apalutamide plus abiraterone, both compared to LHRH analogs, and there's really no difference. That's why we're not doing that combination right now. So if you shift to the other place where we've had a lot of activity, and that's metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, this is, of course, patients who have evidence of metastasis walk in the door or after primary therapy progress with metastatic disease. This has been probably one of the most studied areas of prostate cancer in the last decade. And you can see the trials. This was a review article of 10 randomized clinical trials. I added the 11th, which I'm going to talk about in a second, ARANOTE, because it was just presented last year at ESMO. But if you look at the doublet therapies, that is ADT versus ADT plus an ARPI, you can see the hazard ratios for survival are 0.63 to 0.81, so very significant. And if you look at the triplet therapies, there are two studies here, Arisense, which I'll talk briefly about in piece one, you can see that in both of these studies, chemotherapy was the third treatment. And again, you see the hazard ratio for survival was significantly in favor of the additive treatment, in this case, an ARPI. So I'm just going to give you some quick updates on the follow-up studies that basically looked at the use of a second drug, a combination in hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. I try not to use the word treatment intensification. I use combination therapy mostly because I think we don't want to scare people off from using these treatments. It turns out in the United States, only about half to maybe at most two-thirds now of patients receive this. Now, I'm proud to say oncologists give more of this than maybe the laggards or urologists, but unfortunately not all patients are receiving this despite those survival benefits I showed earlier. But this is the follow-up from Latitude, which, as you know, was ADT versus ADT plus ABI, and you can see that a significant benefit persists. We can talk a little bit about StopCap, which was just shown that suggested that men over the age of 75 probably should not get abiraterone, but we can talk more about that. This is the apalutamide study, and you can see, again, the hazard ratio, 0.65, very similar, with longer follow-up, has shown a persistent benefit. And this is the third study. Also, the exact same survival benefit. This is with enzalutamide, and you can see that enzalutamide has a hazard ratio of 0.65 or 35% improvement in overall survival in MHSPC. I mentioned that ARANOTE is the newest study from ESMO. It started later, and so we saw some data from last September where it was really darolutamide added to ADT versus ADT alone. With PFS as the primary endpoint, you can see there a significant PFS benefit. I should point out, we don't see OS data yet. It's not mature. So unlike the other studies I showed you where we have OS benefit, we don't have it yet with ARANOTE. But you can see the PSA responses and time to PSA progression very significant in favor of darolutamide in the MHSPC setting. And the safety, what's interesting about darolutamide is that it seems to have a really favorable safety profile. And in particular, I call out the treatment emergent adverse events from this randomized trial compared to placebo. And you know that a treatment is pretty well tolerated when the actual number of events is actually lower in the treatment arm compared to placebo. You know, that I think that really says something about how well tolerated it is. Yeah. Arisense, as a reminder, this is the triplet therapy. That's everyone got six cycles of chemo with ADT, and then half got darolutamide, and the other half got a placebo, and this was published several years ago. Again, darolutamide, when added to the combo of ADT plus chemo, reduced risk of death by 32.5%. But the question that still has not been answered that we can talk a little bit about is who should get chemo? It's not fully answered. And these are some key secondary endpoints from ARASENS. Huge differences in time to CRPC, less in time to pain progression. And in the last minute, I'm just going to tell you about studies that we don't have the results of yet, but we probably will have some data very soon on basically about a quarter of these patients are P10 deficient. That is MHSPC patients. Maybe half of CRPC patients are P10 deficient. And P10 is a tumor suppressor that leads to activation of this pathway called PI3K-AKT. And you already have PI3K inhibitors in breast cancer. We're looking at this in prostate cancer. And this was a poster presented a few years ago on Capitello 281. You're not meant to read these slides. But if you look here, you can see that basically they're screening all these tumors. This is MHSPC for P10 deficiency. And once they're determined to be P10 deficient, you're randomized 1-to-1 to receive ADT plus abiraterone plus or minus capatasertib, which is a PI3K inhibitor. And what we know is a press release has come out. I was watching some of the earlier presentations. This is where we first learn almost always is a press release comes out that suggests that this is a positive study with regard to RPFS. So we'll be hearing more about this. And there's an ongoing CRPC study with the same drug in combination with cabazitaxel versus placebo in CRPC. And here the eligibility and study is ongoing. So look out for that. And that's in your handout. So I'll pause there.
So a bunch of questions in a second. I'm going to be curious to hear from Sunil whether he ever sees M0 disease or the urologist keep it manage those patients. And have you encountered patients where you considered the EMBARK strategy? But Raul, first, thanks for helping me clean up my papers. Sure. The GYN boys threw me into a brain fog. I think I'm coming out of it now. But anyhow, getting back to EMBARK, you know, when I first saw EMBARK, just like William was saying, I was stunned, you know, not really that surprised, but amazing to think that this therapy, LHRH agonist that we've been using for years, was clearly not as effective as bicalutamide alone. Yeah, of course, the combination was better, but that was very striking, and I was thinking, wow. And yet, when I started asking GU investigators, they were very, at least in the beginning, not very excited about monotherapy. I kind of, at least it sounds like Williams may be more interested in it. One of the things, incidentally, I'm curious is, I'm not sure if you talked about sexual function on enzalutamide. I think it's better. Is that true or not, Raul?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, there's trade-offs with a monotherapy with enzalutamide. I think the things that are better, you see less hot flashes, you see better sexual side effects, and probably, as William said, better global overall well-being. The trade-off being is more gynecomastia and breast tenderness, but there are strategies to really deal with that in terms of prophylactic breast radiation, just one fraction of radiation. Sometimes we use tamoxifen if the breast tenderness is significant. So I agree with William. That was definitely striking data from the EMBARK study.
You know, I was saying, are you going to present it as an option? A lot of people are saying no. Do you present it as an option?
You know, what's interesting with EMBARK, as well as my study with Presto, is that, you know, this was conducted in the era before PSMA PET imaging. And so, you know, the challenge now is how do we take those data into the modern era where we're getting PET imaging? Most of these patients have metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Do we extrapolate and give everyone intensified or combination hormone therapy? But I do think it's worth a discussion for those patients that have, you know, PET-negative disease, rapid PSA doubling time. Intensified therapy improves outcomes, and that's the take-home message from EMBARK.
William, for those who do have positive PSMA scans, first of all, how often is it oligometastatic, and do you ever use local therapy rather than systemic therapy? Would you use chemotherapy in a patient like that?
Yeah, I mean, the whole disease state is changing because of PSMA PET. So remember, these are so-called biochemical recurrence, means that the PSA is rising, but we can't see it on a bone or CT scan. We can see it much more often on a PSMA PET scan. So the whole space is really changing. And to answer your question, if I see a single lymph node or a handful of a single bone met or a couple bone mets, I will actually consider radiating those patients, because I believe that you can get, and there's actually randomized data that shows that you can delay progression. Doesn't tell you can improve survival, but you can delay progression. So that's how PSMA PET has changed my practice. I almost always, though, do use some form of hormonal therapy. And I should point out that I don't use enzalutamide monotherapy in every patient right up front. What I often do is patients themselves have very strong opinions about ADT. Many of them were on ADT before and they do not like it. And so it's most commonly I use it in the setting where a patient does not want to go on androgen suppression therapy.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, look, the combination data looks incredible. I don't know if you ever heard Matt Smith talk about the pelican graph. Have you ever heard that? Yeah. Because it's so wide that it looks like a pelican opening. I showed that to the breast people last night, too. So, Sunil, any questions about what we're talking about? Sunil has a 90-year-old, an 87-year-old, and a 73-year-old.
We see quite a few 90-year-olds,
yeah,
so that's difficult sometimes to decide.
So, yeah, what about this 90-year-old?
Yeah, see, this 90-year-old patient, he was diagnosed prostate cancer in 1995. So what, about 30 years ago when he was 60 or whatever. And then he was treated with radiation. After some years, he fell through, crack. Nobody was following him. He goes to emergency room with abdominal pain, peritoneal mets all over. So I haven't seen too many peritoneal mets alone with prostate cancer. But with history, we did PSA. And PSA was 1,400. And biopsy consistent with metastatic prostate cancer. So to us, we started on leuprolide and abiraterone in that. He did well, but he's progressing. So now what? Docetaxel? At 90, we have to start thinking. And my another question is, if I give docetaxel, can I give weekly rather than 3 weekly so I have a little more control? I know there is 1 month, 2 month survival advantage. But is it really matters in 90 year quality of life-wise? I thought weekly is better.
What about lutetium?
Usually no insurance pays lutetium before we give docetaxel.
Not yet.
That's my problem.
We're hoping this year they will.
Yeah. Okay, if it changes, I would give lutetium without any argument. But right now, I have to be practical.
Yeah.
So, William, what do you think about this case? You know, delayed mets 30 years later sounds like breast cancer.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual, and peritoneal mets, as you say, are very unusual. But the PSA tells me this is still androgen-driven. So, and you said he responded to the combo with abiraterone. I will point out, I mentioned it briefly, at GU ASCO this year, just a few weeks ago, we learned that if you're over 75, abiraterone may not be the best choice, just as an FYI. Probably has more cardiovascular effects than we realized.
Yeah, I heard you say that. I was like, where did that come from? So it was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate a little? What did they look at there?
Yeah, so what they did was, it was a meta-analysis, but they had all the individual patient data from all the randomized trials using abiraterone, enzalutamide, and apalutamide, about half of the data from Enza and Apa, in HSPC. And in those studies, everyone under the age of 75 benefited from all three drugs, just like I showed. But if you were over 75, the survival benefit was null. It was one, because it seemed like it had a prostate cancer benefit with abiraterone, but not an overall survival benefit, which meant that there were probably more cardiac toxicities in the 75-year-olds or older. So if you were younger than 75, you still had the benefit from abiraterone, but if you were older than 75, basically, there was no overall survival benefit with abiraterone.
I mean, there's always been this thing about cardiovascular disease and abiraterone, but what's the mechanism?
I'm not sure, but we all have seen, basically, I think there's the steroid may have an effect. I think that there may be more cardiovascular events, even subclinical. But you definitely see the prostate cancer-specific survival is actually better, but then the overall survival is equivalent, which suggests, again, you did the right thing, 100%. But I think when we see data like this, the thing that came out of GU ASCO that a lot of people were saying was maybe we shouldn't use abiraterone if the man is over 75.
I'll definitely remember that. Because I see a lot of more than 75.
Yes,
quite
a few.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear about your 73-year-old. But first, before we get into that, Raul, going back to sort of a basic clinical question, which I think relates to this case as well, is the issue of chemo for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease.
Yeah.
And it was kind of weird the way the research from outside of prostate cancer, us looking in, like, why were you doing these studies? You know, at one point during the pandemic, it was either add-on endocrine intensification or docetaxel.
Yeah.
And then you had these triplets coming out, and then, you know, there's the Arisen study, but there wasn't a trial, there wasn't an arm in there that had Ayersen's, had darolutamide alone. I love that, you know, the data you showed there with darolutamide, less discontinuation than placebo. Incredible. But now that this has all kind of been washed in, out, and around, Raul, who gets chemo?
It's a great question. I mean, that's the big unanswered question in the hormone-sensitive space, is we don't have that randomized trial of the ADT plus ARPI plus minus docetaxel. There are trials underway, but it'll be, you know, a while before we get that question answered. So I really look at metastatic hormone-sensitive disease as a two-by-two table, really the high-volume versus low-volume disease status based on imaging. And then are they de novo metastatic, present with metastatic disease, or is it recurrent metastatic? So for that quadrant, that's high volume de novo metastatic patients, particularly those younger patients that are fit for chemotherapy, that's currently the group that I'm offering triplet therapy to. So ADT plus ARPI plus docetaxel. Your choice there being being abiraterone or darolutamide based on the PEACE study as well as Aerosense. And then there are some molecular features. If there's RB1 loss, if there's focal neuroendocrine differentiation, if there's liver metastases, those are, you know, additional factors that I might look at.
So another question before we hear another case. So William, you're talking about capivasertib, the AKT inhibitor. Yes, we talk about it all the time. Last night, we talked about it a lot. We did a poster in San Antonio about how people utilize it. And you guys are just kind of getting into it. It sounds like it's going to be part of prostate cancer management. I'm curious what we know about tolerability. You know, the breast, we have a lot of things we talk about in breast cancer, particularly glucose control, not so much with CAPI. Some of the other agents are even worse, alpelisib, which is used with PIK3, rash, et cetera. What do we know in prostate cancer in these men, how they tolerate CAPI, and do you see this coming on board, and in what situation?
Well, we haven't seen the tolerability in the phase 3 study yet. But this is what I would say. In general, for reasons that are still unclear, men seem to tolerate many of these drugs worse.
Not worse.
Even, yeah, I've seen this when you look at these new classes of drugs, women with lung cancer, with breast cancer, all comers with lung cancer, they seem to tolerate some of these targeted therapies worse in prostate cancer. We've seen, you know, cabazitaxel is going to be talked about a little bit. I'm sorry, cabozantinib will be talked about a little bit later. My hypothesis is that ADT has this detrimental effect on prostate cancer patients in general, that they just age out more. So I think that it will be a new game for us in this space with PI3 kinase inhibitors. I think that in general, I worry a little bit about tolerability.
Well, I'm kind of curious, Sunil, I'm sure, have you used CAPI in breast cancer?
Yeah, I have CAPI in breast cancer. But of course, not one in prostate.
And also in breast, they use it, was it 4 days on, 3 days off? Is that what you all are doing, the same thing, or is it continuous?
No, in the studies, it's on-off. It's 4 days on with each cycle. Yeah.
So Sunil, you have, what about your 73-year-old?
The 73-year-old gentleman just came to me a couple of weeks ago. Patient went to, like, never went to doctors, just one of those people who don't believe in doctors. But then he developed significant hematuria, so he had no choice. So he went to the doctor, he went to the doctor and found out that he had prostate cancer. And then his PSA was, I forgot exact number, but it was fairly high. And it was Gleason 9, okay? So issue is PSMS scan shows bone met, lymph node mets, and lymph node all over. So it was not just pelvic, but even supraclavicular. So issue is, I thought he is fairly healthy, so I would go with triple darolutamide and leuprolide and docetaxel. Is that the standard of care, number one? And number two, what is the value of Orgovyx in all those questions? That I don't know.
You know, you're describing him as not too doctor-oriented. William, do you think it'd be reasonable to present the option of not including chemo, or do you really think chemo is necessary?
I think, you know, as Rahul pointed out, it's hard to know. I don't want to scare the patient off right away. My strategy in these patients is to start the ADT and RP first. I can talk about Orgovyx in a second, Relugolix, I should say.
Yes,
sir. But the The general strategy is how do we select the patients? And if he's younger and healthier, and I don't know why he's bleeding right now, I would push for a more immediate combination therapy, and I would strongly consider chemo for a patient like this, if this is all prostate cancer-related bleeding.
It is prostate cancer-related bleeding. That's why I was thinking triple, but he was ready. I think the daughter who worked for a physician kind of pushed him. Hey, you better do something, you know?
Right.
So
this is where the stepwise approach does make a difference, right? You have someone that's not well connected with a healthcare system, you know, get them on ADT plus ARPI, see them back in a month or two, make sure they're, you know, adherent to the medication, PSA is going down, hopefully symptoms improving, and then have the conversation with the triplet, add on docetaxel. It's a lot to present all of that at the initial visit with someone newly diagnosed metastatic disease.
So, Raul, I would like you to go through some of the new and emerging therapies in castrate-resistant metastatic disease. But one other thing just to bring back up to William that we didn't comment on about EMBARK that I want to bring up in general, but also about the M0 situation, was that the therapy with EMBARK was all intermittent. You know, they treated till the PSA went away and they stopped and then, you know, waited for it to come back. Is that what you're doing with your patients?
I am doing it with more patients than I ever used to. And I think it's because there's a growing body of evidence that suggests that they do not need to be on it lifelong. And many of the patients appreciate it. We have a biomarker that we can follow very closely, PSA. And we have a second biomarker that we can assess their disease, PSMA. So we actually have a better ways of following them. So I do a lot more intermittent than I used to.
And do you find patients feel much better once they come off?
Yes, for sure. Even with ENZA monotherapy, they feel better off of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The ENZA is also intermittent. Any other situations outside of M0 where you use intermittent therapy, William?
I mean, in theory, for example, MHSPC, you're supposed to use it for the rest of your life. And people have written editorials that say you should use it for the combo for the rest of your life, but I don't do that in practice. If they get to zero, their PSA is zero, I may do some imaging if I'm allowed to. You can't get a PSMA PET covered if your PSA is zero. So I may do a CT and a bone scan. And if they're in complete remission, I do sometimes have that conversation, particularly when the patient is having a lot of side effects from treatment.
Interesting. All right, Raul, let's take a look at some data.
Great. Sounds good. Well, there's a lot to cover. I'll try to get there in 10 minutes here. So we're going to talk about three topics. One is combining these ARPIs with PARP inhibition. We'll talk about some of the radiopharmaceutical data in mCRPC, and then some of the exciting emerging treatment options that are not yet FDA approved, but may become so eventually. So first, focusing on the AR plus PARP inhibition, we are very focused on the HRR mutant mCRPC population because this is not trivial. This is about a quarter of our patients that have an HRR mutation. Of those, a little over half have BRCA2, which is really the most important mutation to detect. It's important that we get both germline and somatic testing. So for example, with BRCA2, it's about half-half. If you only get germline testing, you're missing about half of the mutations that are somatic only. This is just a real-world data set sort of emphasizing that point. But there are other crucial mutations to test for, so we should not just get BRCA hereditary testing, but a full panel. In particular, things like PALB2 may also be very sensitive to PARP inhibition.
Huh.
We have single-agent PARP inhibitor data, and those agents are approved for mCRPC, but increasingly there's been interest in combining AR pathway blockade with PARP inhibition. Based on this co-dependent pathways. So when we block PARP inhibition, when we use a PARP inhibitor, we see less expression of AR-dependent genes. And conversely, when we block AR, this may increase PARP signaling and therefore provide the rationale for dual blockade. And there's really three studies that we'll go through one by one by one. There's the PROPEL study. We'll start with that. This was a randomized phase 3 study that looked at first-line mCRPC not selected by HRR mutation. This is all comers. Most, if not all, patients did not have a prior ARPI. They're randomized to olaparib plus abiraterone versus placebo plus abiraterone. So this is really a paradigm shift. Rather than focusing on those HRR mutations, can we treat all comers and see a benefit, with RPFS being the primary endpoint of this study? In the all comers population, we see a benefit both with respect to PFS and a trend towards benefit with overall survival, although it's worth pointing out that the hazard ratio of 0.81 did not quite meet the pre-specified efficacy boundary for OS. But really, it's important to look at the subgroups, because the subgroups really tell us the story about, well, what's driving that benefit? And if you focus on the Kaplan-Meier curves on the right for overall survival, you see that it's really the BRCA mutant patients that are driving that overall benefit with a really impressive hazard ratio of 0.29, a 71% improvement in survival in BRCA mutated first-line mCRPC patients that get the combo of abiraterone plus olaparib. Whereas in those that are wild type, you can see that there's really, really very little difference in the two arms. Let's next talk about the MAGNITUDE study. This was similar but not identical design. This was looking at the combination of niraparib plus abiraterone. The key difference here is this was a pre-specified analysis where they looked at HRR mutant and HRR wild type patients as two separate cohorts in a pre-specified manner, analyzed statistically independently between those two groups of patients. And what they found is that in the HR wild-type patients, there essentially was no benefit with respect to PSA or radiographic progression-free survival. This was the interim analysis, the interim endpoint was stopped for futility. So thereafter, the focus was only on the patients with HR mutations. And you can see that there was benefit with respect to RPFS. But similar theme, really the largest magnitude of benefit was driven by the BRCA mutated patients. Lastly, we'll talk about TALAPRO-2. This is the most recent data. The update was just presented at ASCO GU by Neeraj Agarwal. This was a study that was sort of a hybrid between those two that we just talked about. This was prospective assessment of HR alterations, but sequential enrollment in two cohorts. First, all comers, the unselected cohort, and then the HR mutant cohort. So prospectively assessed genomic status, but asking both questions, unselected and the HR mutant, looking at OS as a key secondary and RPFS by central review as the primary. So these are data that were just presented a couple of weeks ago, looking at that unselected all-comers cohort. So that includes wild type, it includes mutant, and it includes unknown, which is actually a pretty decent percentage of patients enrolled on this study. We see that there was benefit with respect to RPFS and a benefit with respect to OS when we look at all comers, as you can see here. The magnitude of the benefit with OS was about 9 months in the combination arm versus single agent ARPI. But again, the subgroups matter. So if you focus first on the right, those that had BRCA 1-2 alterations, the hazard ratio for overall survival was 0.5. So the largest magnitude of benefit there. If you expand that out to HRR alterations overall, which again is about a quarter of mCRPC, still a significant benefit, hazard ratio of 0.62. If you truly dive into those that were known to be wild type, if you take out the unknowns, take out the BRCAs, take out the HRRs, and just focus on the true wild types, there you see actually intriguingly a trend towards benefit with a combo, but did not reach statistical significance with a nominal p-value of 0.1. It's important to look at the safety with this combo. These patients are potentially on a PARP inhibitor for quite a long time. And there was a high grade a rate of anemia. So about 50% of patients with grade 3 or higher anemia. About 40% of patients had an RBC transfusion. About 9% stopped because of the anemia. Key points with the anemia, it is reversible. So if you stop temporarily, allow the blood counts to recover, and then restart at a reduced dose, you generally can manage this toxicity. So in summary, we do think in both germline and somatic testing is important. The combination does improve PFS and OS, but really it's still in the biomarker selected groups, with BRCA driving the largest benefit in this setting. And currently that's where the FDA approvals sit for all three of these combinations, is in the genomically selected population. I think the results of TALAPRO-2 are intriguing in the wild type patients, but really the caveats are this is a smaller magnitude of benefit, and there are careful risk benefits to weigh here. Let's talk about the radiopharmaceuticals. PEACE-3 was a study that was presented at ESMO last fall. This was looking at radium plus enzalutamide versus enzalutamide in first-line mCRPC, so really trying to move radium earlier. This is kind of an interesting trial where they actually mandated use of bone protective agents after a certain point, and that really helped reduce the risk of fractures on this study. They actually saw a benefit with respect to both RPFS and somewhat surprisingly OS with this study at the first interim analysis, suggesting that for some patients we can move radium up earlier in the treatment sequence and give it with that first line ARPI. Safety was generally well tolerated with radium, maybe a little bit higher rates of fatigue and fracture and anemia and neutropenia, but generally pretty balanced toxicity profile between the two arms. Let's talk about lutetium PSMA. This is our beta particle emitting drugs. Obviously had a lot of excitement and enthusiasm. Vision was the first phase 3 study that led to the FDA approval in the post-taxane setting. The important points of this study, the control arm, chemotherapy was not allowed. This was really an AR-directed therapy or best supportive care. But nevertheless, it did show us a pretty clear benefit with lutetium with respect to both RPFS and OS. The magnitude of benefit with OS, about 4-month improval with lutetium PSMA. Generally a pretty well-tolerated drug, but if you focus on the right, you do see that hematologic toxicities in the grade 3 or higher category do exist, particularly anemia and thrombocytopenia, and that can make it challenging to give subsequent therapy. Dry mouth, nausea, fatigue tend to be low-grade with this therapy. PSMA-4 was a drug that was a trial that tested lutetium in the pre-taxane mCRPC setting. The important points here is these patients could not have had prior taxanes, and they were randomized to lutetium versus an ARPI switch, which is debatable whether that's an acceptable control arm in this current era. But nevertheless, showed a pretty clear benefit with RPFS, hazard ratio of 0.5. Crossover was allowed. About half patients did cross over to get lutetium at the time of progression on the control arm. As of now, there's no clear benefit with regards to OS. The hazard ratio 0.98. There are subsequent analyses planned. Finally, I'll talk about some of the emerging treatment options. I want to focus in particular on CONTACT-02. This is an interesting study. We know that checkpoint inhibitors as single agent have very little activity in mCRPC due to the cold microenvironment, but maybe we can combine it with a TKI. So this was cabo-atezo versus an ARPI switch. In a pretty high-risk population, these patients had to have measurable soft tissue disease and consequently had a pretty high rate of visceral metastases. In this trial, there was a modest RPFS benefit with cabo-atezo versus a second ARPI, about a 2-month improvement in median RPFS, but no improvement in overall survival at the final analysis, and only a modest improvement in objective response rate, 4 to 14%. The final OS did show a couple of intriguing results. These are exploratory, these are hypothesis generating, but perhaps a larger magnitude of benefit in those with liver metastases. There is a cost of additional toxicity with the TKI, of course. You can see the grade 3 or higher AE rate was much higher in the combination arm, 40% versus 8%, and the typical TKI-related toxicities, diarrhea, fatigue, hypertension. And then finally, just want to talk about mevrometostat. This was data that was just presented at ASCO GU. It's an EZH2 inhibitor, so an epigenetic regulator, may help restore sensitivity to AR. Showed benefit with the RPFS in a phase 2, and there are phase 3 studies planned with this agent. And then a totally different modality of therapy, but may become part of the treatment armamentarium, bispecific T-cell engagers. This is the Amgen drug targeting STEAP1. Very impressive response rates, phase 3 studies planned, but toxicity managed, particularly CRS and musculoskeletal side effects. So with that, I'll stop and turn it back to Neil.
The bispecific, what are two ends of it? The antigen, what's the other end?
So it's CD3 and it's CD3.
CD3, okay.
And STEAP1, yeah. CD3, so it's a bispecific T-cell engager, promising.
So Sunil, I'm going to skip over your 92-year-old, your 81-year-old, and your 78-year-old, and we can talk about your 80-year-old. I'm curious how your waiting room looks, but William, quick question about radium. William, it seems like, you know, I always thought radium was kind of a cool drug, and people never that excited about it. You have to have bone-only disease, but that's not rare. How are you using it nowadays?
We're still using it mostly third or fourth line, especially with the availability of LU-177 in bone-only patients. Remember that radium had an improvement in OS, but does not really induce responses. Patients may feel a little bit better. That's why PEACE-1 was very surprising. But just as a reminder, in PEACE-1, you could not have received any other therapy first in HSPC. So we just don't see a lot of those patients anymore. But it does suggest that maybe radium is more active than we gave it credit for.
So another question, Raul. Sunil is about to present this 80-year-old who's BRCA2. And I'm just kind of curious. I always hear BRCA2. Do you ever see BRCA1 in prostate cancer?
You do see it. It's rare. It's probably about 1 or 2% of
patients. 1 or 2%.
Yeah. And there's some data out there that may be less responsive to PARP inhibitors, but it's just such a small subset of all these studies. It's hard to get a definitive answer there.
Any idea why?
You know, I think there are differences in terms of the sensitivity to PARP inhibition, the mechanism for that. I don't think it's really been worked out well.
Really interesting. All right, so Neil, what happened with this 80-year-old man?
So there are two 80-year-old. You are
the last
BRCA one.
Yeah, BRCA, the BRCA two.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, you had a BRCA one also. I didn't see that. Okay.
No, but it was ATM.
Oh, ATM. Yeah. Right. Okay.
So, 80-year-old gentleman with group 3 prostate CA. It was diagnosed in 2020. Localized at that time. The guy, no treatment. Went home. 4 years later, bone mets. Came back because it was painful. So he came, and the question is, what do we start? So I started, you may not like, but leuprolide, abiraterone, and olaparib in this, okay? And because I thought BRCA2 positive, so I should go with olaparib. Is the right
thing. Started them on it up front.
Yeah. They are paying for it now, olaparib as frontline, so I started him on that. He doesn't like olaparib much, but he's taking it right now.
Yeah. Okay.
So is that the correct way to go, or what is your opinion?
Why doesn't he like it, incidentally?
He's basically feeling fatigue and nausea. Mm-hmm. I'm telling that nausea usually fades away. That's what we heard. Tachyphylaxis happened with nausea today. So that's what I'm trying to tell him to, and just trying to support him.
And he's had some cytopenias also?
Cytopenias are not bad in this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but let me understand, this is he's got hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, right? No
yeah.
prior therapy. I don't know that PARP inhibitors approved in that situation, is it?
Not yet.
It always seemed like a very logical idea.
Very logical.
I can
yeah.
certainly, you know, I was like, why not? But would you have given this, if you could have, I guess you were able to get it paid for,
yeah.
William?
Yeah.
Would you have given him olaparib?
We actually yeah. see a lot of these patients who come in knowing that they're BRCA positive, germline particularly, sometimes somatic, and we start them on typical combination therapy. These are patients that may respond better to chemo because we know that they have a more aggressive. So let's say this patient might have benefited from chemo plus ADT plus an ARPI, right?
Yeah.
But right now, because it's not approved, I typically cannot give a PARP inhibitor, but I think it would work. I think it would help this
patient. I mean, if you could, would you give it to a patient?
I think it was very reasonable to try. Absolutely.
Raul?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there are data coming very soon in the hormone-sensitive metastatic setting in BRCA-mutated patients. I mean, look, it's all about the risk-benefit. Keep in mind that in the hormone-sensitive setting, these patients are on PARP inhibitor potentially for years. So you're really wanting that bar for safety, efficacy really goes up as you start to move into the hormone-sensitive setting. And one of the things we haven't talked about is really the risk of AML, MDS. These are older men. You know, they have compromised bone marrow. So I'd want to see that kind of full data set before I made that decision.
All right. Another case, I'm really interesting, 76-year-old younger person, MSI-high prostate cancer. Well, let's hear about this 76-year-old man, your fourth case.
76-year-old guy. Presented with prostate cancer with signet ring features. And that I have not seen too much. Gleason was 9, 4 plus 5, and Foundation said liquid NGS showed MSI high. Now, he was under care of another doctor, and at that time, patient got standard docetaxel and enzalutamide. Then he had disease progression. So I put him on Pembro because of MSI high. It's a He's doing wonderful. He loves it. Every 3 weeks he comes, PSA is 0 for like 1.5 years, 2 years, roughly speaking.
He's been on Pembro for 1.5, 2 years?
Yes.
And he had an objective response?
Yes, 0 PSA.
Wow, 0. And any autoimmune issues?
Nope.
So William, your experience with MSI-high prostate cancer?
Yeah, it's very similar. As you know, in prostate cancer, this is visible. This is seen about 1% to 2% of the time. And this experience is not uncommon if it's a genuine MSI high or TMB high, which we see, you know, fairly rarely. But it does; these patients do respond.
So can I ask?
Go ahead.
I have another patient. I'm not presenting the whole case, but TMB high when you said that. And that guy is also responding very well. I've never seen TMB high I see in all other cancers. And in other cancers, I don't see long-term response. This is 1.5 year. He's doing so well.
How high was the TMB?
20.
That's, yeah.
But not MSI high?
No. That was not MSI. So two different cases. I have it.
Right, yeah, I understand. Raul, you know, we have this indication for Pembro, yeah. TMB grade. Was it, incidentally, is that TMB on a liquid biopsy or?
Liquid biopsy, a 90-year-old guy. He was sent because everything failed.
Right, right.
And I put him on Pembro. 1.5 years, yeah. He's so happy.
He had an objective, objective response?
Objective, PSA zero.
Very nice to see.
So I haven't heard such great responses just when TMB.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting. And we get excited about a TMB of 20 in prostate cancer because usually we sit in the 1 to 3 range. so this is really, and there is starting to be data. These are rare subsets, but there is data that in the TMB high, MS stable, you can see, you know, dramatic responses to checkpoint inhibitor. Certainly worth a try.
Like it was not a fluke. It is
no, it's a real, it's a real thing for sure. We get excited about it.
Interesting. Yes.
So, William, question from the audience. Do you ever see, we talked about this in breast cancer. Do you ever see PALB2 mutant prostate cancer, and how do you deal with it?
Yeah, I think the most interesting question, and as Rahul was going through it, are the non-BRCA2 subsets, including, by the way, BRCA1. We know in liquid biopsy, ATMs are often clonal hematopoiesis, so my suggestion always is to also look at tissue if you're able to. But PALB2 and CDK12 are two very interesting subsets. From the recent data with TALAPRO2, we will see some data on more data on CDK12 as a potentially responsive element, but PALB2 seems to be responsive as well.
Raul, interesting question from the audience from Oli. Could you please elaborate on the management of a male assigned at birth transgender woman who's diagnosed with prostate cancer?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great question. I think we're still kind of figuring out how best to manage these patients. They need multidisciplinary care, right? There are a lot of issues related to the hormone therapy. Do you give continuous, intermittent? The psychosocial aspects to their care is really important. I think what's gratifying is I think there's more awareness of this as an area that we need to focus on. And I think our center is starting to develop the kind of expertise in terms of the different multidisciplinary management that we really need to have for these patients.
William?
Yeah, I mean, remember, a lot of them are on estrogen therapy. And what's interesting about estrogen, of course, is it's both a treatment for advanced prostate cancer and also maybe protective against prostate cancer. So I would want to know what his hormonal status is and whether she's on hormones or not, because I think that might make a difference. But when they progress through estrogen therapy, that's like, castration-resistant prostate cancer. Yeah.
And how do you manage it?
I think the same way we would with any other CRPC patient, which is, are they a candidate for chemotherapy? Are they a candidate for LU177, et cetera?
I love you. You have great cases to discuss. So thank you so much. We're going to take a break. I'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.